Hey, this is Chuck Dixon, and you're listening to Signal of Doom.
Well, you know, for me, the action is the juice. I'm in.
Hello, you're on Signal of Doom, and I have a special guest, Drew Geraci, the Marvel Encyclopedia, returns. Drew, how are you?
Are you reaching my signal?
I have it, Drew. We've been lost in deep space. This has been kind of like, I think it's almost like Nixon going to China. It's been very diplomatic endeavor to get this show together, and it's all my own fault. And finally, here we are, Drew, to discuss a topic close to your heart, Captain America, the Bloodstone Hunt.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you're into the Grunewald era, Cap, because for some reason it really gets ignored. And, you know, my opinion is that he did so many issues that people take you for granted after a while, kind of like John Byrne's Fantastic Four. It's like if he only did a year or two, you would hear about it all the time. But I guess so many issues were out there, people take them for granted. But they're both great reads.
Yes, very interesting point. I mean, I think in modern to a modern day reader like myself who came in with Brubaker, it's almost like there was this feeling that the 80s Cap was going to be kind of cheesy and sort of pale in imitation. But when you read it, because we read previously on the show, or we discussed with you, I think, Drew, the Captain storyline, which takes place shortly before Bloodstone Hunt, and then we've done the Bloodstone Hunt. I see, yes, there is a cheesy element, but what there really is a really solid storyline, a very, very dynamic supporting cast. I find it I put it up there with Englehart's Cap, Grimwald's Cap, and Brubaker's Cap. They're my favorite ones. You know what I mean?
That's pretty much, yeah, those are my sweet spots too, you know, and as going back to a point I made earlier, it's like Roger Stern and John Byrne were on way too briefly for 8 issues. But if they were around 5 years, people would probably take them for granted. But all the ones you mentioned are just fantastic.
Yeah, and I mean, I agree with you. You know my feelings on Roger Stern, but unfortunately with that run, it's great, but it's just so brief. It's almost like an interlude, you know? But Grunewald, like, let's dig in here, Drew. Give us the 10-cent pitch. Like, I assume you were reading back in the 80s during this run. Were you picking this up in stores?
Yeah, I was picking them up with convenience stores, you know, as well as comic shops. I was lucky that in Pittsburgh there was this store called Ides Comics. They've been around since 72, and it was always near where I went to the Art Institute of Pittsburgh, or it was just a half-hour bus ride down. And I would get Captain America on and off, though, but it usually had to do with economics. I'd be out of my own and broke, so I would pick up, like, you know, a couple books. But with Grunewald, you got a lot of meat. You know, when you buy an issue of Cap, you knew you were going to have a good read, you know, solid read.
Yeah, he loves connecting dots. I'll tell you something that straight away, from the very beginning, I love this about Grunewald's Cap. It's before the internet. Okay, and mobile phones. And so communication isn't so accessible. And I love the constant sort of, like, there's always a state of, like, Cap's going to check in later on with someone else when he finishes his adventure. You get the feeling like there's always a lot of subplots boiling behind the primary plot with Grunewald's Cap. He's always working on a lot of things at once. And partly that is, like, today, it would require much more suspension of disbelief, because you could go, well, he can just call Diamondback on his mobile while he's out doing this instead of waiting 2 weeks to check in and find her. But I love that kind of stuff. Like, yes, it is kind of cheesy, but it's also a lot of fun. And I think fun is really something that Grunewald really seems to achieve regularly. Like, I've got to say, like, my estimation of him as a writer at Marvel has gone up remarkably after reading this Cap, you know? And let's not forget the art, Drew. Like, I had a couple of names here. Is his name Kieran Dwyer?
I believe so.
pretty good, man, I've got to say, in punching out some pretty complicated art. And I would say, I think, better than a lot of modern Marvel art, you know, in the current comics.
Yeah. I mean, I tend to agree, mostly because, I mean, he's not splashy. Like, a lot of people now go for splashy at the expense of storytelling. But with Kieron, his stuff was all – and then Ron Lim folds into Ron Lim. Both of them, you never question what you're looking at. And, you know, if you and I were to script the book, we could just look at his pencils and say, okay, this is happening, because they're just solid – I mean, you know, I know Grunewald wrote the plots, but I'm just saying. I think they did it Marvel style. I'm not sure.
I noticed Kieron Dwyer did have some plot accreditation in some of the issues. It says something like that. It goes like Grunewald scripting / plot, and then Dwyer like pencils / plot as well. So he had some input, obviously. You know.
Yeah, they worked together for a few years, so I guess they just. We're finishing each other's sentences, or just getting more of a, you know, just kept them interested in Cap, you know, just to collaborate that way, other than just artist, you know, writer.
Isn't it interesting that that's got out of fashion, though? The kind of like what I'd almost call meat and potato style storytelling, where it is really nice to look at, but it also tells the story really well. I wonder why that is not as popular at Marvel at the moment. Like, because to me, you can't beat it, you know?
You see, I look at it this way. What's weird is nowadays, from the big two, there's a lot of talking head stuff. And I think what it is they're trying to show that comics aren't just for kids anymore. And instead of having a dust up, is that what you would say? A dust up? Instead, they go around talking about their feelings all the time. And there was always a place for that. I mean, Stan Lee did that way back when, but it's just now that's become predominant. And you wonder why these people are wearing costumes when they're just sitting around small talk.
Yeah.
And, but with Grunewald, it was like, damn the torpedoes, but he also fit in. Little sub, you know, like Diamondback's, you know, slow rehabilitation from being a villain to basically Cap sidekick. And then you had Ethan Sikowski or whatever his name, who was this pest who used to create robots that attacked the Avengers. And then finally he realized he sucked at it, so he became a mechanic.
Is that Fabian?
That's it, Fabian. I'm sorry.
He's in there. He's tucked away in the lab, isn't he? He did mention something to that effect. I like the fact that Grunewald obviously knew a lot about Marvel and kind of he was doing some fairly deep dives. I would have thought, Drew, this is right up your alley, actually. He clearly brought back people that had only been in one issue, you know, many years ago. He was quite expert at that. And can I say, Diamondback for me, I think – where is she these days? Because I think she brings so much personality to this book. And by having Cap – she's a girl from the wrong side of the tracks. And Cap is such a straight arrow. The two just play off each other so well.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you don't mind if we give the occasional spoiler, do you?
Go for him. No, go for it, man.
We could just say that now and say, you know, come back in 10 minutes or whatever. But – I mean, right towards the end of the book, I mean, they have their first date as Steve Rogers and Rachel. I can't remember her last name.
Leighton.
She had pink hair for the longest time. And he at first he was kind of stuffy about it. You know, he's a little more conservative about it. So she dyed her hair like a regular chestnut brown. And they had a normal date. And it was brilliant that a couple of her former friends or when she was with the Serpent Squadron.
Yeah, her colleagues in the Serpent Society. Yeah.
Well, a couple of them, most of them cut ties with her, but a handful of them did not, and they followed them on that date. And anytime there was any trouble that was going to interrupt the date, her friends in the Serpent Society would intervene. So it just seemed like a perfectly quiet night for the two of them, but really they were being protected, and it was such a great idea.
I love that issue. That was one of my favorite issues. Just a nice character piece and a bit of comedy as well goes a long way. Like when he takes her to the old place he used to go with Bernie, this is Cap. You know, he's a man of like routine, and then it's closed and he has to take her to Mexican. So he's kind of getting outside his comfort zone. And she's just a delight. I mean, she really is a good girl. I mean, for all this talk about how she's such a bad girl, she's really quite a good girl. She actually does quite a lot for Cap. He's quite slow to warm to her. But then he's kind of lying back in bed and he starts thinking, hey, Diamondback ain't so bad. And I'm like, yeah, that's right, Cap, finally, you know. Get some loving in your life.
you get the impression she was decent growing up, and then something bad happened, and maybe that's why she turned, or, you know, was desperate. I mean, so and then she realized after she got her head straight eventually, sure, that you know, hey, you know, why am I in this group of teams, villains? It's Cap guy is such an example of what is good and what is likable, and so that's where she, you know, that's where she.
I've got,
you know,
to say, influenced her. The Serpent Society. We haven't seen them in the movies. And then, yes, they're bad, but they're not that bad, like, in terms of evil organizations. Like, and I enjoyed some of the previous storylines which had a bit of interaction within the society. I could see a Marvel movie that would focus on the adventures of the Serpent Society, or with them as, like, sort of like the villain. And, you know, there's some interesting storylines to be had there. There's some rich material is what I'm trying to say.
You know, I never thought about a cinematic version of the Serpent Society, but that would be brilliant.
I'd love
I'd be all over that. And
that means Diamondback would get a run too.
That's true, but they would have to contact you for casting. It would have to be you.
Yeah.
So you're the final say.
Thank you, Drew. And look, I've got a Diamondback series inside of me, for seriously, that I would love to go to Marvel with, because I think she is a character that is, like, just so ready for a return and revamp. Like, she could slot so well into the current situation. She's an absolute delight. Now, if we go through the book, Drew, one of the things that I really like when it kicked off, Cap's very much saying he needs to get the Avengers ready for the 90s, and then before you know it, he's sucked into shenanigans with S.H.I.E.L.D. and Nick Fury, and then he faces the Soviet super soldiers. And, like... Yeah. When I saw that the Soviets were going to be involved, I thought, oh, this is just going to be Rocky IV. You know what I mean? But yeah, actually, yeah. it's towards the end of the Cold War, or at least that part of the Cold War, because does it really ever truly end? But, like, it's when Gorbachev was in one panel. So it's towards the end of the Soviet Union. And actually, it was a far more sympathetic story than I expected.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That was interesting.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, what I liked was they didn't drag it out for, you know, the length of a trade paperback. You know?
No.
So, I don't know, just a handful of issues. But, yeah, they in fact, I'd forgotten they were in there until you told me. And I'm flipping through my pages crazy, like, looking for them. And I thought, oh, there they are.
Yeah, they're right at the front.
One of the pages I was looking at is turn to page 317 in your Cap Epic volume 50 people or children.
Yeah.
And there's this great scene where she's flipping this guy, this big kingpin looking thug guy, grabbing her with a Garrett from behind. She flips him over.
Oh, I love that one. Yeah.
She whacks him with a pipe, and he does nothing but smile. And there's this blank expression on her face that is so precious. It's so, it's like, it's a face that a lot of artists could not pull off, because it's scared and then also stunned.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, what the F, you know?
Well, there's something hammy and fun about Diamondback. Like, when she goes to Singapore and they tie her up in the brothel, and then she beats up the woman, the madame of the brothel. And then she comes out, and all the other, like, basically whores are there with their, like, you know, knives and stuff. And she just does this really cool smile with all her teeth. And then she turns tail and runs. she's funny. It's so funny how she shadows Cap throughout, like, the whole second half of the Epic collection. And Cap's just sort of like, oh, Diamondback, you again. And then he's sort of, like, slowly warming up to her. She's so desperate for his approval. She's like a little puppy.
Right.
And Cap,
she knows not to go overtly, because she'll scare him off.
Exactly, yeah. She knows that he's just he's a traditionalist. But there's actually a good issue at the back end issues. There's one called Girl Talk. I don't know if it made it into the Epic collections. Did it get in there, Drew?
I got to look at the...
Basically, after she went out, I think it's after she went out on the...
That is the very last one, Girl Talk.
Yeah. She went out on the tape with him. She came back, and one of her friends, I forget which one of the Serpent Society it was, the one who has the dark power thing. She's sort of saying to her, they sort of have a discussion. She's like, what will you give up to be with him? And, like, how will you make money and everything? It's actually quite a cool issue, because Diamondback's, like, seriously thinking, like, if I give up my life of crime, you know, how will I earn? Do the Avengers pay? I'm not Avengers material. And then she calls up her friend the next day and says, does your sister still have the beauty salon? And she's like, yeah. She goes, yeah, can I get a sales job or a desk job or whatever? She says, like, it was just it's just a fun little character moment, but I enjoyed it.
Great was that, I mean, as we said before, that, I mean, the Serpent Society was all these serpent-related characters since Stan and Jack, and which was just amazingly threaded together to be a corporation that, you know, happens to be they happen to be in a thieving business, and it's just so well done. And what's great is he doesn't delineate, or Grunewald does not delineate, this person's bad, this person's good. No. It's like there's some people that after Rachel quits, cut her off, and then some others that, just like you said, Black Mamba comes at the very end, and she's very sympathetic. And and it's kind of like when you change jobs and you don't hang out with the jerks that you work with, but there are some that you got on with and you would see them. So I love the complexity of the relationship, you know, with Serpent Society and Diamondback.
Yeah, I imagine that, like, you made a good comment when you said Grunewald put a lot of meat in these issues. I didn't pick Cap, I admit, I didn't pick Cap up in the 80s, although I do remember him being on shelves. But if I had picked him up, I would have been very satisfied with the story, because I think he puts a lot of detail, a little bit of nuance into it. Like, in a way, he's kind of slightly ahead of his time, and I do mean slightly. Like, it's a more complicated and nuanced tale than you would expect. Like, Captain America in the 80s, from my memory, he kind of wasn't the coolest character. Like, you know, I love Cap now, but he wasn't – he was kind of like the your dad's comic, it kind of felt like, you know?
Oh, yeah. It wasn't until Brubaker and Epting that he became cool, you know? I mean, because those stories are so riveting, and they were so – you know, I mean, Cap was a top 10 book, and actually it was a number one book for a while there when those two took over. But I just wanted to tell you real quick, I was thumbing through this again, and I loved a few issues of Acts of Vengeance, which was a fantastic crossover from 1990.
Oh, yeah.
That's, and Cap's fighting a Controller, who he never fought before, because Controller is an Iron Man foe. And I so love it when somebody like Mark Grunewald takes someone else's enemy and has them pit against, you know, a different hero, because it changes the whole feel of it. You know, just it's a whole fresh look at an old, at two old characters.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, Drew, Acts of Vengeance, wasn't that the whole hook that everyone's, all the villains swapped around so that, like,
exactly.
Yeah, kind of a neat idea, really.
Well, what's interesting, though, is like people like Grunewald and Byrne, they sometimes did that anyway, but it's like Grunewald took the ball and ran with it. Yeah. And also you see, like you said, there's a lot of Serpent Society information in this. And I also saved a page where Cobra wants to be the commander after Sidewinder leaves, or he bails for some reason, and nobody respects Cobra.
Yeah.
And he says, well, I have to make them respect me. So he goes out and seeks Mr. Hyde, who he's been afraid of all these years, and he took him down.
Like, because they formerly were a duo, weren't they, at some point?
Yeah, and then, like, sometime after, I don't know, around – it was, like, during this Roger Stern Spider-Man era Mr. Hyde and the Cobra, who were pals, you know, they were a team ever since Thor from 1964. Mm. And Hyde got real ticked off and swore he was going to kill Cobra, because Cobra escaped and did not, he didn't want Hyde to escape as well, because he was just terrified of him, even though they were partners. So ever since then, like for 10 years, Hyde has always hated Cobra. And then in this backstory, what's great is there's like a 17-page front story and 5-page backup story in pretty much every issue here.
Yeah.
And, he takes on Mr. Hyde, because he's like, that's my one big fear is Mr. Hyde. And if I could take him out, then I'll get respect and be able to run the Serpent Society in Sidewinder's absence. And he did that. He became King Cobra and updated his costume and stuff.
I say good for him.
Yeah.
I love the Serpent Society, man. I really think that you could get some great visuals today. Like, they could obviously update people. I've got a question. Why was Diamondback in the Serpent Society? What does throwing diamonds have to do with serpents? Everyone else had kind of like a sort of snake motif. She doesn't really.
As silly as it is, it was just because of her name.
Oh, really?
Isn't that crazy?
She's got this, her stripper name Diamondback was enough to get her in. Good for her.
She's just stripping so she could work her way through college.
Did you see the bit where she took Cap out on the date? She's like, oh, there's the old building where I hung out with my first gang. She goes, team.
I know.
And then she goes, brilliant. That's where I got my first kiss. And he goes, huh. It's like, well, Cap, you were going to take her to your ex-girlfriend and, you know, your old eating place with Bernie. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, something else I wanted to touch on, Drew. Now, we discussed, it feels like eons ago now, but I think when we first probably were chatting, the Captain series with, is his name John Walker?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, that's wrapping up. Basically, the issue that this kicks out with is the issue after he got assassinated, in quotes. And so the very beginning of this epic collection does actually still deal with the aftermath of John Walker's assassination. Now, Drew, just for readers who've been reading the epic collection, could you give them a little piece on what happened to John Walker after he looked like he had died? And what titles does he go to and all that kind of stuff?
Oh, well, what happened was the government did a fake assassination at a press conference out in the public. And first it was like page one or two of the issue when Steve Rogers resumes Cap, being Cap at like 351. And he he goes on a speech and then he gets shot and Cap chases after the killer. I don't know, it might have been one of those justices served scourge guys. But
yeah.
They basically did it to cover up so he could reinvent. They could, what do you call that? Go black, I guess is what they call it when you're not supposed to be around. If you're like an undercover character that is off the books officially. So then he, he took over Cap's outfit and became U.S. agent. And he was changed from John Walker to Jack Daniels. I guess somebody liked their liquor.
Oh.
It's sort of a nudge-nudge wink thing.
And is this in West Coast Avengers?
Say that again, please.
Was it in West Coast Avengers that he did this?
I remember in the backup stories of this epic, they touched on that, but it wasn't until West Coast Avengers that they really got into. Byrne really got into doing more. But Grunewald set a lot of that up. And Grunewald was his editor at West Coast Avengers, so I think they had a lot of communication about how the story should go. And I've always said I love U.S. Agent because he's a combination of Cap and Wolverine. He's got that berserker rage going sometimes.
Yeah, I've got a question, though. This is what puzzles me. Okay, so U.S. Agent is pretty much he's wearing the black Cap outfit and he's like, more violent than Cap kind of thing. Like he's a bit more crazy. But I don't understand, so he was in West Coast Avengers as U.S. agent in the black thing, and no one sort of questioned. Did people think it was Cap, or did they just accept there was another guy called U.S. agent?
And they knew right off. So
everyone knew straight away that he was the former Cap.
They knew because they had known when the real Cap had come back, and then one day U.S. agent just showed up, knocking on the front door, and they didn't know who he was.
Yeah.
And he basically went back. He was ex-military, and he sort of went back into like a commander kind of attitude, like, "Okay, I'm here. Where do I? Where's my room and stuff like that." He wasn't a commander, but he just fell into a paramilitary stance that was from his background. And he basically said, okay, I'm here to make sure you guys, keep an eye on you guys and make sure you're doing right by the government. And, cause he's very much a patriot, but he was also a bit distorted because he saw his parents slaughtered before him during the Captain.
He's an interesting character. It's interesting. This is what I find interesting about U.S. Agent. Considering that he was kind of the villain of the piece in the Captain storyline, like not 100%, but he certainly wasn't all just good. The fact they kept him around in West Coast Avengers and I assume slightly rehabilitated him, it's quite an investment in a character that I would have almost thought was going to be a throwaway character. Is it just because they think the Captain America trademark was good enough to throw over to West Coast Avengers? Like,
I have no idea. I think maybe Grunwald had set it up that, you know, John Walker was dead, and maybe threw the ball to John Byrne because it wasn't that long after. And
sure.
Oh, the other thing too is in West Coast Avengers. Again, we're talking character arcs here.
Mm.
By this issue 40, it's in the late 40s going on. When U.S. Agent shows up, Hawkeye is actually the mature leader of the group, where he used to be the hothead. But, you know, since West Coast Avengers started, Hawkeye had been the, you know, he'd grown up, and he says, I want to do what Cap did and make him proud and be a straight head. So U.S. Agent was sort of like the new Hawkeye, and Hawkeye was like crossover. I can't think of it, but you know what I'm saying. But,
yeah, I get it. Like, Hawkeye became the mature leader, and then he gets this hot shot kind of like, because U.S. Agent kind of has, John Walker had a kind of fairly abrasive personality, so you could definitely play that off well against other characters.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, he could do things, he would say and do things that were really obnoxious, not caring about the other people, and they would just write him off like, oh, what a jerk, and he'd walk away. And then later on, he'll do something really nice. It's like he, you know, this was touched on years later in Maximum Security miniseries that Kurt Busiek and Jerry Ordway did in 2000. But, you know, he basically has an attitude of like, nobody insults my family except me. So he was kind of like the little jerk to the Avengers, and that's way down the road. He became a jerk to them, but then later on, one of his cronies was walking by and said, oh, you showed those Avengers. And he's like, you shut up. You can't shine their shoes. So he's sort of a very complex character.
I was going to say, he's a complicated guy. You know, I just wanted to kind of get that. And just wrapping that up, Drew, like for a reader like myself, okay, and for people out there who've got invested in Cap, when we go back and read these 80s sort of stories, you do get a real feeling that there is really much a very shared universe in Marvel. Like, there's still a lot of, you know, editor's notes.
Was still there.
Yeah, yeah. And apparently, from what I know, Mark Grunwald was very big on continuity. I've read in a couple of articles. Now, I personally am not a slave to continuity, but I do think it can serve a story and universe well, and he certainly knows how to do it. You know, are you sort of like when you're reading it now, and you're seeing those notes to West Coast Avengers? How does like a West Coast Avengers stack up compared to this Cap run? Because this Cap run is pretty high quality. Like, I'd give it an 8.5 out of 10, even higher maybe. Or are you sort of content to leave that John Byrne West Coast Avengers in the past, and you know this is kind of a high part of that era or not? Like.
Yeah, well, West Coast Avengers was fairly wobbly. I mean, start off with Steve Englehart and Al Milgrom, and Joe Sinnott was inking it, which really made the art much more palatable, because sometimes Al's a little uneven. I'll just be polite and say that, but he's a good guy. But it was really a throwback, like the 60s. I mean, it was they had so many panels where someone's falling when, like, their rope is cut, and they'll be like, oh, no, the rope is cut. I'll never make it to safety. And, like, there was a lot of it. It was weird because Steve Englehart sort of took a major step backwards in his writing and kind of wrote it very, you know, very early Stan and Jack, not even like the good Stan and Jack of the 65 Silver Surfer era.
But, was he trying to go for a feel, basically, you think? Yeah. Like, yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, in the post-Frank Miller era, and it just really
– yeah,
it was kind of silly. But it was a guilty pleasure. I liked it. You know, I liked it because – had Iron Man, had Hawkeye, had Wonder Man, three of my favorite characters. So, and it was very cheesy. But then when, in fact, I actually stopped about a year before Byrne came on board because the quality was just really declining. And when Byrne came, oh my God, that's great stuff! You got to check it out.
I probably would like to check it out in Marvel Unlimited. I've got the Marvel Unlimited service, Drew, which I would heavily recommend to listeners out there, because I read most of the Cap stuff we did this show on the Marvel Unlimited service. And, Drew, really, I don't mean to be a pitch man for Marvel Unlimited, but you're paying something like about $60 a year, something like that.
Yeah, that's a good deal.
And it's damn near everything. Everything goes on there. And for all this old stuff, I mean, it's all there, and they're forever adding more details to it. I'm actually turning into a big fan of the service. Got a question though, Drew. Talking, just wrapping up West Coast Avengers, do you foresee them making a movie out of West Coast Avengers? Like, now that we've got Avengers Infinity War, I definitely, something we've discussed on the show is the likelihood of them splitting off West Coast Avengers with some of the current Avengers and some new ones coming in. Could you see that happening as a movie franchise?
I could see it, but I don't see them doing it. They've got so much other stuff on their plate, and it's not even suggested, but I would so love that. I mean, I would sooner skip, you know, the next couple other movies that are coming up and just do more Avengers, because you can't get enough. It's good stuff.
Oh, it's good stuff. Where are you on, say, Captain Marvel as a movie? Because I'm really looking forward to Captain Marvel, man, to be honest.
I think it'll be good. You know, it's so weird that we haven't seen any real trailers for it, but I keep an open mind, you know, because even if I hear different, like, there's some movies of Marvel's that I liked, some I didn't like, and then but the majority of it is like, you know, I'll still take a crappy Marvel movie over one that was never made, because when I was a kid, you know, you had those cheesy TV movies with from the 70s that were just so horrible.
They look so bad, like that Captain America in the motorcycle helmet or whatever. It just looks so bad.
Completely wrong.
As a little kid, and I'm talking like I wouldn't have even been 10, I remember on TV them screening the Amazing Spider-Man, you know, TV movies, and I was in love. It's actually how I fell in love with Spider-Man, but like, I know they would suck now, but Jesus Christ, I love them as a little kid, you know?
Yeah. I was going to say is going back to the epic, which probably one of my favorite non-Cap stories is the Acts of Vengeance, where Magneto goes after the Red Skull.
We've got to talk about this because it's a great issue, isn't it?
It you know, and Kieran Dwyer really amped up his. I mean, it's the most beautiful piece most beautiful issue that he's ever done.
Yeah, it's great. Like, and I mean, like, let's face it. Like, it makes so much sense. Magneto, like, as we know, at times has kind of been like the mindless villain, but usually slightly more nuanced. But he's always had the Holocaust, you know, origin story. And for him to be partnering with Red Skull, a stooge of the Nazi Party originally, like a creation of Hitler, makes no sense. And to have Magneto stand up to Red Skull and just totally brutalize Red Skull and then lock him up in that, like, you know, sort of like prison underneath the earth.
Oh, yeah, just like so many gallons of water. And he said, you know, if you drink this much per day, you may live, you know, a couple of months. And it's just like he basically put it back on the Red Skull, you know, of what he put Magneto's people through, you know. That was so – I could read that one. I have it in my spinner rack. I thumb through it once in a while because it's so great.
I read it for the first time, Drew, last night. And I think I'd heard about it, as in, but nothing prepared me. Because really, frankly, it comes out of nowhere in the Epic Collection, doesn't it? Like, suddenly you're in Acts of Vengeance, and then suddenly that issue happens. There's not much forewarning. It's a great issue. And for Magneto, because I love Magneto, like, from you know, when the 90s movies and stuff, and got me into it.
Who doesn't?
Yeah. for anyone who loves Magneto, they've got to read this issue because it really is Magneto showing his true colors. And I really appreciated that issue. And, I mean, Red Skull is just such a slime bag that was just great to see him locked up and just forced, you know, under the ground.
Yeah, it says 367 in the Epic, so that's the issue. And it's a standalone story, which is great. And I miss that too, because just like the dating story that we spoke of earlier, that was done in one issue, and it was a lot of fun. There was some action because, you know, the fellow serpent females were helping out, you know, make the date go smooth. And so it's like Grunewald give you a little bit of everything. And back when I did buy Cap pretty much most of the time, because I was really broke when I moved out on my own, and I could only afford like maybe 3-4 comics tops throughout the month. And Cap I would always get, you know, for that reason, because I'd be so damn broke I could reread it and reread it.
I appreciate that, man. Like, economics, when you're moving out of home and you've got a comic habit, you know, you really have to get very selective. I think pretty much everyone who's ever collected comics would appreciate that story, Drew, because that is the eternal I was saying recently I had Jim from King's Comics on the show, and I always bought weekly 2000 AD, and I remember when the price jumped from 95 cents to $1.20. And I gave the guy behind the counter my dollar, and he's like, "Nah, kid, $1.20." And I was, in my brain, I'm like, "Great," because you know I had, you know, I was just a student. But I've got something to say actually on this topic. Now, Drew, I really believe a lot of my favorite issues ever are one shots. Like, I love a long story. Don't get me wrong, but one-shots can really do so much for a character and can build a really neat contained storyline, which still pays off into later stories. And I'm so frustrated when I hear writers talk about how their editors tell them that they can't write one-shots because they can't fit them into a trade. It's just so frustrating to me, Drew, because I feel like comics, like mainstream comics, big two, there is so much of a place for one-shots. Like, I can think of some of my favorite storylines in Punisher, like some of Chuck Dixon's Punisher one-shots. They're amazing, you know?
Absolutely.
And Cap as well.
Yeah. I'm sorry, go on.
No, that's kind of my point, Drew. I mean, as someone who's worked in the industry for such a long period, you've probably witnessed and heard about this from editors where it's just like, oh, we can't fit it into a trade. And I'm kind of like, how can't you fit it? It's literally just a one shot. Like, you can put it at the back end of the storyline. Like, typically if you've got, like, Bloodstone Saga, okay, or Bloodstone ran for about 6 issues, and then you put a one shot at the end of that. Like, how hard is that?
Yeah. I mean, that's a shame because now the books are done by committee and they have the next half year planned out. And you're, you know, like when, oh gosh, I mean, there were several books that have been derailed in the middle because of a forced crossover. And sure, that was okay with Secret Wars in the beginning in 1984. But
yeah,
aside from that, though, I mean, they're also dragging these stories out. I mean, it's maddening because there's some solo issues that are my very favorite issues, just like you said. You know,
yeah,
it's like where, you know, there was beginning and end. And Jim Shooter used to say, every comic is some kid's first comic.
I agree.
You make it entry level.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Like, we did I'll give you an example. We did a comic on the, you know, show this week called Infinity, I forget what it's called. I think it's called Infinity War 1 or something like that. Like, it's Infinity Wars 1. It's done by Jerry Duggan. I love Jerry Duggan as a writer. So I've gone on many times how much I love Jerry Duggan as a writer on the show. The issue's got fantastic art. I think it's got Mike Deodato on art. So it's got beautiful art. Now, the problem is, you read this issue, Drew, you honestly feel like you've missed about 45 issues coming in. Like, the lead-up is ridiculous, and it's this thing where they say, oh, it came up on the show, oh, there's an Infinity Wars Prime issue. And I'm like, why can't that be called one? And why can't that lead-in issue be the first issue? Why do we have to have this kind of, like, I don't want to have to pick a book off the shelf and a little bit of material I can understand, catch up. But when I'm completely lost and I have to read, like, the issue halfway through the issue before I start to get my bearings, I find that very disorientating as a reader. It's just a bugbear of mine. I feel like, I know it started with 0 issues, and I'm sort of like, those 0 issues, I would far prefer they would have been called one and we just kick the event off. Like, why call it zero? It's either relevant or it's not, sort of thing, you know?
When Bob Layton and David Michelinie were doing Iron Man, the first – they did 2 runs, but the first run was from 79 to 81 or something. But they did a lot of standalone issues where, you know, you just sort of knew you're at Stark International. And he created those guys created a lot of ancillary characters who were employees. One was a PR person who was nervous all the time, and one was Mrs. Arbogast.
I remember her.
And what's great is they had this one guy, a security guy, who had a security chief. This is well after Happy Hogan disappeared many years ago. But they had a security chief that sort of had a dark past, you know, and it led eventually Whiplash showed up, and it was associated. Whiplash was actually hired to kill this guy who had this dark secret. And then Tony forgives him in the end because he sort of knows, he judges him as, you know, this guy hasn't been, you know, this guy hasn't been in trouble in many years, years ago. Since I've hired him and stuff. But it was a standalone issue, and it was like it gave you so much in just one issue. Mm. You know, had funny moments, had, you know, dark moments, a little of everything. And that's, you know, there are a lot of good individual issues that really – you know, charm the hell out of you. You know,
yeah, and they can broaden the world. I almost feel like that's such a great example, Drew. I almost feel as if the current cycle, and Marvel to me seem particularly guilty of this, it's almost like they're so reliant on their IP that they're not broadening it out at all. Like, so they're not adding any depth, character depth at all, or nuance to it at all. They're not building the supporting cast very well. I don't know, they're just there's something fundamental that I'm not connecting with right now in a lot of the Marvel titles I read. And it's so obvious when I go back and read like an 80s Cap that, frankly, it's just so much better, you know, like in so yeah. many ways. And that's not to say that, for example, I thought the issue in the Epic Collection where Cap turns into a teenager, I thought that was a very poor issue, personally.
Yeah, that started out the book, the first few issues. And
yeah.
Boy, those are some stinkers. I actually remember not buying those issues and then resuming later.
Yeah. Like, when I was a teenager, Drew, and I had my allowance, whatever it was, it certainly wasn't a fortune, I'd be guilty. I'd be at the newsstand and I'd do the quick flip through before I considered, unless it was Punisher. I flipped through many an Iron Man issue going, okay, is this good? Everything looks good? Yep, fine. If I flipped through that Cap issue where he's a teenager, that would have gone straight back on the shelf. The art was appalling. Yep. The storyline just seemed ridiculous. Like, so there were low points. Like, I don't want listeners to think that Dave's just saying, oh, everything was great in the 80s. No, there were definitely low points, even inside this Epic Collection. But I still think that overall, I take what I've read of Grunewald's Cap over a lot of, you know, a lot of the modern Marvel crop right now, frankly.
Yeah, you know what? It's funny you say that because I did stop buying several books for the reason you mentioned that. Some of the books were just going on and on too much, and X-Men is one of the, you know, the biggest guilty ones. And I quit that with issue 200 because nothing seemed to ever get resolved. He's always adding new stuff, but
sure.
And I just thought, you know, I'd like to have a little satisfaction of an ending. But an example of a great 80s solo issue, actually a couple of them, is during Roger Stern and Paul Smith's Doctor Strange, and that is just like the best that the 80s could ever offer. It was
really
issue. It was the first issue that Roger Stern had been writing. He did it with Marshall Rogers, and then there was a fill-in issue by Michael Friggin Golden. So you mean he had like the top-tier artists?
Yeah, I was going to say that's the big names.
And then with 56, it was a standalone issue. And what was great about it was, if you hadn't read a comic book from Doctor Strange ever before, it gave you everything. It starts off with this woman who is who's a journalist, and she's a TV journalist, and she goes into the Sanctum Sanctorum, and only because she's gotten to know Doctor Strange fairly well and he's trustworthy, and he comes down the steps, and it's the same. That design they use in the movie, you know, is exactly taken from Paul Smith's design in the second issue. He comes down the steps, and she talks to him, and he speaks about, you know, his origin and a bit like that. And then it's like one of the people, she has a few people in tow with her camera group, and one of them is like a sorcerer from back in the Lee Ditko days, and he totally disguised himself. And then towards the end, when Doctor Strange tells a story, then he sees he's been taunting the guy clear as day. Like, he could tell the guy right away was a fake when he came in. He just played it calm so it wouldn't be a big brouhaha where people would get hurt.
And
but it was genius. And the next issue, about a year later, 66, I think, was where there were these what are they called? Monks. They had a couple of monks show up, and they were looking for the next their version of the Dalai Lama. You know,
mm-hmm.
You know, where it's a baby born and doesn't even know it's a leader yet. And that is such a great issue because they're trying to figure out who the person is. They run into several people, and then at the end, it's just got such a great It's humorous. It's satisfying.
I tell you what, Drew, like, we have a section on the show called Lonely Hearts where we pick out, like, classic issues from the past, just, like, single issues. I will hunt those down and we'll add those to the show so that we'll actually do a full discussion on the show. So I'll try to get that done by next week, listeners. And I'll get the copy of those issues because I assume they're on Marvel Unlimited or fairly easy to find. That sounds great. Although I love Roger Stern, I've never really been a big Doctor Strange guy, but Stu, my co-host on the show, is a huge Doctor Strange guy, and we recently did a recent Jason Aaron Doctor Strange, which was very good. And speaking of modern creators, Drew, I wanted to get your opinion. Do you read much Jason Aaron, who's done, like, Wolverine and the X-Men, and he's currently on Avengers, he's done Thor for a long time? He's a very, very good writer.
I like him better on most of the writers. Like, I'm not a Jonathan Hickman fan for some reason. Like, but I mean, it's interesting. My big thing is with comics is it just seems like they want to have the characters do everything, anything but fight. So if the girlfriend or whoever shows up and sees a comic, and they'll think you're stupid. That's old school, and that's how I grew up. But they wanted to see, it's giving a message. Oh, it's so important. But it's like,
Jason Aaron definitely has his characters fight, and I actually really like Jason Aaron. I think he's kind of a bit of an unsung hero at Marvel sometimes, and he's now taken over the Avengers, Drew, and it's definitely got more of a classic feel to it. But I would always point you to his Thor run. His Mighty Thor run is fantastic.
I'll check it out.
Read from the beginning. Like, he's Thor, God of Thunder, from the beginning. I'd be very interested to hear what someone like you thinks about it, because he certainly does have a more classic feel than a lot of the more modern writers. He's very gifted. And that Doctor Strange we read was very good, and I'm not a big Doctor Strange guy, and it was very good. So,
I was going to say is that Roger Stern, who you and I have gushed over his Spider-Man era, he's what got me into Doctor Strange. I was just when Marshall Rogers came on and he came on, I was like, oh, this looks interesting, beautiful art. And I was like, wow, this is a great story. And then it just got better and better when Paul Smith became the regular artist. And there was even a Kevin Nolan issue.
I love beautiful. Paul Smith. I know Paul Smith from X-Men. He was pretty good. He was pretty damn good. Yeah.
And what's interesting is this is after X-Men. He actually left X-Men to go to do Doctor Strange because he changed his style and became really more ornate, but not in a George Perez, jigsaw puzzle kind of way. It's just that he experimented with just different faces and different visuals, and good stuff. But I don't mean to stray too much from Cap, but that Cap epic is worth it.
I think it's it's worth talking about because all we're talking about are things that are of the era, and that's what's important. Yeah, that's
right. You tied it all together. I just remember that.
One thing I like about these sort of time capsule reads is sometimes you really get a feeling for what's going on in the greater Marvel world, and certainly this, like, for example, in the issues of the Acts of Vengeance, you heard mention the Superhero Registration Act, which I've read before in some Fantastic Four comics, where they sort of did the Superhero Registration Act was done in the 80s, well before Civil War in the 2000s. It had the 80s one, where Reed Richards turns up at the hearing and Apocalypse flies over Washington, etc. I love that kind of stuff. Like, Marvel really enjoyed tying things together, giving you the impression of what really was a living world. And I mean, I still think that there's something to that. I still think that that's a really enjoyable part of reading those Marvel comics. It made you feel like you were part of the world. In a way.
I think we're living in an age of where I wish there was more continuity-minded writers, but it's sort of like choose your own story or choose your own continuity or just do your own thing with the character. And some people do recall, older characters and put them in. Because if we literally after all these years, the superheroes would have – their grandchildren would be the superheroes now. I mean, they'd all be – there's no way they could have 500 issues of action without, falling apart or dying or ending up in a mental ward. But
look, I think continuity can be I'm not a continuity whore. I just think it can be of assistance at times. And I probably would be guilty of going my own direction too, but I just like the feeling at times when they reference other events in the world. I've always liked that, like not overly doing it, but I like a little mention of something else going on somewhere. And I know Marvel have sort of played that at times up and then other times dialed it down. These Marvel retreats I would love to be at a Marvel retreat and hear them go through stuff, because a couple of times in recent years they've gone down directions which were complete icebergs that they've hit, like for example Secret Empire, Cap, you know, that was a fucking iceberg. But other times they've hit it out of the park.
Original Sin,
you know?
Either. Yeah.
What did you say?
Original Sin I didn't like at all. It was kind of dumb. I don't know.
I wasn't a huge fan of Original Sin. That was an event that didn't do much for me. But regardless, Captain America, the Bloodstone Hunt Epic Collection, actually collects 20 issues, I believe, 351 to 371. So actually, you get a lot of bang for your buck with these epic collections, Drew. I was having a conversation recently with Jim from King's Comics, and I know you've spoken about Marvel Masterworks, and Jim was a bit, you know, sad because Epic Collections have overtaken Marvel Masterworks. But would you... I think one of the reasons they're probably popular is, A, they're in soft cover, and B, they give you the full cover picture, whereas the Marvel Masterworks had sort of the silver banner, you know, the box around the side. Now, I know it's a very simple thing, but I think the Epic Collections probably are a bit more palatable to a more casual fan, because you get the full pop of the cover, plus it's a soft cover, so it's slightly less expensive. I mean, what do you think, Drew?
You know what? I don't know if I agree about the cover thing. I think mostly it has to do with the economics that you had mentioned, because, I do get some Marvel Masterworks, but I prefer Epics because, as we discussed, you get a ton more story. And they're U.S., they're $34.99 or $39.99, depending on how thick they are.
And you can get a better deal on Amazon and stuff with them, too.
They're like 500 pages. And then, but with Marvel Masterworks, you may get 300 pages for $75. What pisses me off is I purchased a Marvel Masterworks that later showed up as an Epic Collection.
Yeah.
And I was like, if I knew that, I wouldn't have spent. Because I have a friend who, some people only buy hardcovers, or some people only, you know, collect certain things. But, you know, I'm like the little boy fanboy where I just want as much as I want. You know, it's like, we're all cheap. It's like, I used to go to the quarter bins all day, and then a lot of people hit the dollar bins, you know, because, more is desirable because, price.
I think they've hit a sweet spot with the Epic Collections. The sheer thickness of them, for me, makes me feel like I'm getting a good deal when I pick one up. You know, I like knowing that there's a lot coming out. Now, just something I do want to mention on the show, while I've got you on, you might remember many times I've been tweeting Marvel about releasing Mike Barron's Punisher run, and it's kind of been a campaign of mine for several years. Well, I think it's December this year, Circle of Blood Epic Collection's coming out covering the Circle of Blood mini and the first 10 issues of Mike's run and Assassin's Guild, the graphic novel. Then in February, something called Kingpin Rules is coming out, which collects, I think, issues 10 to 20-something of Mike's run. Now, I do feel, Drew, would you agree that finally my tweet campaign's paid off?
Absolutely. I ran across that, too, how you, skim Amazon and you see stuff? Sometimes I'll just type in Epic Collection, and then all of a sudden I'll see the next batch of Epic Collection that just been – One of them was the Punisher one that you just mentioned, you know?
Yep.
And I was just like, that's sweet, because that stuff has been out of print so long.
Well, and they've collected Circle of Blood 1,000 times. I've got it in hardcover, Drew. I've got the original softcover I bought in the 80s. Okay, so I've got the original softcover still. I've got a hardcover I bought in early 2000s. I've got Back to the War Omnibus, which collects it as well. Back to the War collects all the original Punisher stuff and includes Circle of Blood at the end, whereas this Circle of Blood Epic Collection finally does Circle of Blood as the beginning and then into Mike's run, which is perfect because that's exactly how it happened in real life, you know?
Yeah. Like you said, I've been thinking it's about time. I'm just chafing at the bit for Chuck Dixon's Moon Knight from 1988.
Yeah.
You know, that's never, ever been. You know what? Actually, a couple issues were collected in an Axe of Vengeance crossover omnibus.
Yeah, but that doesn't count, does it? Like, we want the proper thing.
Well, I want more.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it had like two issues of it was Chuck with Sal Velluto and Tom Palmer. And there was also a couple issues of Mike Barron and Bill. I can't think of his name. Anyway, with
Sienkiewicz?
No. It is. Goodness me. I can't think of his name. Anyway, but.
I named the one Bill I knew from comics.
Yeah.
I know Bill Mantlo and Bill Sienkiewicz are my two names.
I'm lost. We said there was – oh, what was I getting at? Oh,
you were basically saying, Drew, that in Acts of Vengeance crossover there was some Mike Barron, I think you were saying.
There was some Mike Barron – yeah. Okay, now I remember now. In the Acts of Vengeance crossovers omnibus, it has Mike Barron and Bill Reinhold's Punisher, and it's a 2 or 3 issue story where.
Oh yes, it's Punisher in. I believe it's in an annual or something. Yes,
he ends up fighting Doctor Doom.
I love that,
and it's such a brilliant way of approaching it. You know, it's just. I mean, it's not just like, you know, he stands in front of him and allows himself to get zapped or whatever, but it's more like. Kind of like Die Hard, where it's like a hit and run sort of thing, or they kind of, or it's actually almost like a chess game where they try to outfox each other, you know, the Punisher and Doom.
Yeah.
And so I got a hint of those in that one.
You got a taste.
I want more.
And I believe, Drew, from memory, I think that may have taken place, in an annual potentially. Certainly he fought Moon Knight in an annual. But anyway, in the second epic collection that's coming out in February, it does include 2 annuals. And I think it collects 10 to possibly 25 of Mike's run. I think it might be 10 to 25 of Mike's run and 2 annuals.
Nice.
So it's a nice, solid collection. And I'll be honest, this hasn't been collected, I don't think, since if it was collected maybe in the 80s. But it hasn't been collected ever, really, you know, Mike's run, which is crazy.
It never was because Marvel didn't get serious about trade paperbacks until – around 2000, which is insane. There was some store that sold CDs, comics, books, and cool clothes, you know, like Ren and Stimpy shirts and shit like
sure.
that. But it was called Media Play. Yeah, it sold video games too. But anyway, I would go over and the trade paperback section was so threadbare, you'd be shocked. And they were also... They'd have crappy covers by some new kid you never heard about, and I bought them like that early Bloodstone Hunt. They didn't have any schedule, which is weird because DC was really getting on the hardcover and softcover collections in the mid '90s, and I kept thinking, why isn't Marvel doing that? That's like printing money.
Yeah, it's amazing because it led me into you're right. DC got ahead of the game. There's a whole show in this, Drew, about how slow both publishers were really to realize how popular trade paperbacks were, because in the 80s they collected Dark Knight Returns as a trade paperback and Watchmen, for example, and they sold squillions. So how they didn't apply that to the rest of their line, I just don't know.
Maybe they knew those two were going to be, you know.
You would think you would take a chance.
But you'd think they'd be evergreen, but it's but as that aside, you know, you could even take – let's say 1/4 of all the Marvel comics that have ever existed, and you put them in trade paperback, and they would sell because there's that many great ones. There's crap too, like, you know. But I mean, these epics are great because you know those 3 stories where it has at the beginning of the epic collection that's really crappy. It has the Sisters of Sin and all this stuff. It's like. You wouldn't buy that as a trade, but with Epic Collection, it's like a little bonus.
Yeah, and you flip through it, and then you're on to the next story. No, I agree. Look, thankfully, we live in a world where finally Marvel and DC did wake up and realize they could really monetize their line by including these trades, because, frankly, that's where I've built up my knowledge and my library over the last 10 to 15 years, as I'm sure many people have. Now, Drew, okay, so to wrap it up with a bow... But Captain America Bloodstone Hunt Epic Collection, I think hopefully we've sold the audience. If you're a Cap fan, get this, you know?
And if you don't buy it, we'll hate you forever.
Well, Frank Castle will come and hunt you down. Because he loves Cap 2, and he wants you to read your Cap.
That's right. They just don't have the same methods.
Yeah. He's a little more deranged. This is truly a really fun read, and I honestly think it's a real nice companion piece to the Captain storyline, which immediately precedes it. And you just get a feeling for how busy a writer Mark Gruenwald was and how much territory he covers in those two collections. Like, there's a lot of information, isn't there, Drew, in both collections?
If it was decompressed for modern books, it would probably be like 5 years worth of work.
I don't even want to think about that, yeah.
And just one last aside I want to say real quick is the thing about the trade paperbacks, I mean, it's a great format, but we've lost the subplot. I mean, there would be books that would be like a subplot for that would bleed over into the next run of a storyline, but they can't do that anymore. They have to have a chopping off point. But, you know, Gruenwald's Cap, you just get so much bang for your buck, you know.
Sure do.
And he understood the format, and he loved it. And he had an encyclopedic knowledge of the Marvel Universe, you know, even more than me.
You are the Marvel Encyclopedia now, Drew, since he sadly passed away, but I think you're carrying on the legacy very well. Yeah, for sure. No, definitely grab this, and if you're just kind of on the fence, like I'm not sure, this is a good one to kick out with, because this is a fun issue. Fantastic art throughout, great storyline, I love it. Drew, where can listeners find you? Give us the Demands novel, etc. Give us the 10-cent pitch, man.
Yes, on Amazon is a two-book series so far. Third book coming out in about a month or two. It's called The Demands. It's named after the band called The Demands, a indie band in Pittsburgh that plays at bars owned by the Russian mob. There's The Demands Book 1. There's Demands Book 2 called B-Sides. And then the third one, The Demands Stage Dive, will be coming out within a month or two.
Wow, dive.
It's got romance, it's got action, it's got really crude humor, and it's got got a little bit of death and, you know, drugs and rock and roll.
Who can say no to that combination, Drew? That sounds like the winning ticket.
I'm going to be, in August, I'm going to be in Pikeville, Kentucky for their convention there. And did I say August 25th? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then September, I'm going to Little Rock, Arkansas on the September 8th and 9th.
Okay. Is that where Bill Clinton's from? I seem to recall Little Rock, Arkansas getting a mention when Bill Clinton's name was mentioned.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I had a flashback to the mid-90s and just hearing that like all the time.
Yeah.
Cool.
I'll be out and about.
Excellent.
If anybody wants to come to my table and talk about Gruenwald's Cap, I'd be more than happy to continue.
Yes, and Drew, I've seen some of the stuff you put up on Facebook recently, these inking commissions and stuff you do. Like, there's been a lot of pretty interesting stuff you've been doing recently, like, you know, inking over, Gene Colan stuff and all this kind of material that I've seen on your Facebook.
Oh, yeah. I love that stuff. I mean, my commissions are the funnest part of anything. I mean, comics are great, but too many modern pencilers are so tight that it's sort of a trace job, as Kevin Smith would say. But I mean, the older artists just are a lot looser, and I love that ability of playing. And also, it's pretty wild to think that I could actually have made it as an inker during the Silver Age, because I've amassed so many versions and formats of styles. I'm not even saying that properly, but I've just absorbed all stuff that I fear no penciler.
I think some of the stuff I see in your page is pretty cool. Like, I love it. I think it's really cool. And so check Drew out on Facebook, and you do commissions there, don't you, Drew? Two people can sort of like,
yes.
People basically say, Drew, you know, I want this, I want that, or they give you the art and then you do the inking. Is that how it works?
I'll either do pencil or inking, or if you have an artist who's penciled it but not inked it, I'll ink that. And the rates vary, but I'm very, very reasonable. And unlike some creators, I keep in constant touch and don't disappear. I know several people from like the 80s that just have dropped the ball as far as, you know, I hear people saying, oh, he's supposed to have a commission 2 years ago, and yet he's taking on new ones now. I'm like, that's wrong.
Drew is very reliable. You are very reliable, Drew. And I'm just so pleased we've finally done Bloodstone Hunt. I promise I won't leave the next Drew's Views waiting this long next time. We've actually got a new thing on the show, Drew, that Stu put in place a rule that our weekly trades can't exceed 200 pages because he's sick of me giving 400-page weekly reads.
Sure. That's a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot, and I've only myself to blame. And thankfully, this rule has now been enacted since last week when we did Aliens versus Predator, which was 437 pages, I think. So that was a big read, man. But it was enjoyable because it was Aliens versus Predator. I get a little carried away, you know. But so there's a new rule, which means I won't be as busy with the show, thankfully. It means I'll have a bit more time on my hands.
Now I feel bad for badgering you at the finishing cap, so you just had to read every waking moment.
Man, don't worry. I did it. I'm a trooper. I sat there last night and just polished off the last few issues, and it was really a lot of fun. I mean, I'd give this trade like a 9 out of 10. I think this is really a lot of fun. What would you give it a score, Drew? Where would you go?
Oh, well, I mean, you have to be a classic Marvel fan. I mean, I have a friend, Rob Hunter, who's a fantastic anchor also, and he's not into, you know, the old school stuff as much. I mean, he's more – and he's fantastic too. He's more into like Jim Lee, sure, Wildstorm type stuff, which is fine, and I do enjoy that on an artistic level. But, I mean, I could also accept a story if the art isn't Jim Lee, if it's just like people go crazy about Mike Mignola and he's fine, but it's just I can take pretty much anybody at a certain length as long as the story is strong and as long as the artist is a good storyteller, you know. But
I'm a bit like that. I'll give a lot more room to if the story's churning along and I like it. I it certainly keeps me invested longer, you know. Like I can be forgiving kind of thing. Like, but it's interesting because everyone's different. Well, Drew, thank you so much for being on the show, and thank you for another episode of Drew's Views. We really appreciate it and love to have you back anytime.
It was lovely. Thanks for having me on. Okay.
See you, Drew.